Well, welcome everyone to seminar three. Today we're looking at the sign in the text, and we're going to briefly look at semiotics. And I thought we'd make it more discussion focused this time rather than me rabbiting on. So, and we're going to look at concrete texts. I thought that might be a good way to focus our discussion through contrasting the biblical text with an Upanishadic text. I thought that might be interesting to do that. So what is semiotics then? Semiotics is a study of signs, and it's a study of the communication, the conditions for communication. What are the conditions necessary for any communication? So that's what semiotics is really. It's also called semiology. And it's from the Greek semion, which means sign. I suppose it would be lingatva or something. Sounds good. Mm-hmm. Now, semiotics is the study of signs and language in its broadest sense. So it's very wide. It can mean zoology. It can mean any study of signs, really. So a sign system is like ritual patterns, mating behaviours, cultural systems like dance, all within semiotics, theatre, languages. So it's very, very broad, really. And its origins, its roots, the Western understanding of semiotics, its roots are in hermeneutics. And some argue, like Peter Oakes argues, that its origins are in Augustine. But I don't want to go into all that today. But there are two people, particularly at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of in the 20th century as well, are Ferdinand de Saussure and Charles Sanders Peirce, who are really the founders of semiotics as we understand it today. Now, de Saussure was a linguist, French linguist, who wrote an important book, Course in General Linguistics. And he's really one of the founding fathers of linguistics as a discipline. And he made an important distinction between langue and parole, if you excuse my French accent. Langue is a system of language, like the grammar system and so on, and parole is speech. So langue exists as a total system, and is assumed by parole. So when we're speaking, our speech implies the total system of language, although we're not aware of it. And parole is speech which is in time and particular location, and long is abstract. And so that's an important distinction that he made, which pervades the later system. So semiotics became the system of understanding long, the system of language rather than parole, speech, particular speech utterances. But later semiotics put emphasis on the particularity of speech, on particularity of utterance, on parole rather than law. And this is a quote from Saussure: "The semiotician is attempting to make explicit the system, long, which underlies and makes possible meaningful events, parole. And Saussure is concerned with the system as functioning totality, which is what he calls synchronic analysis, not with the historical provenance of its various elements, which is diachronic analysis." So these two dimensions, synchronic analysis and diachronic analysis. Synchronic analysis is, according to Saussure, the realm of semiotics, really, which is the totality of language, which includes grammar and all the rest of it. Grammar. And diachronic analysis is the study of particular speech utterances at any one time in a historical context. So that he's very influential. Saussure is very extremely influential. The other thing about Saussure, which I actually don't have on the sheet here, is the arbitrary nature of the sign that he's important in talking about. So for Saussure, a sign, what is a sign? Semiotics is the study of sign. What's a sign? A sign is comprises two poles, the signifier and the signified. This is, do you know all this? So this is you know this thing. Should I go through this? Yeah. So the signifier. So that's a tree, and then you've got rickshaw, baum, tree, arbra, and so on. They're all words for the signifier, the tree, the object tree. Now, Saussure said that an arbitrary relation, there's no inherent relationship between the signifiers, the words for the signifiers, the things. It's an arbitrary relationship, purely conventional. There's no inherent connection between the two of them. Bhartra Hari or someone would disagree in the Sanskrit that there is an inherent connection between the Sanskrit language as a sacred language and its reference, what it signifies. But modern linguistics is based on the arbitrary or the conventional relationship between the signifier and the signified. So that's quite important, because it allows for lots of postmodern developments in which that is broken, that link is broken. So we're sort of floating in an ocean of signifiers without signifieds. So there's an interrelationality between them, but no necessary relation to reference any more. We can look at that a little later. So okay, so that's Saussure, long and parole distinction, and the arbitrary nature of the sign. Those two important concepts which he introduces. Across the other side of the Atlantic, about the same time, is Charles Sanders Peirce, who used this word semiotic, which he spelt in a strange kind of way, well, from the Greek E-I-O-T-I-C. And his work, his voluminous work, he is concerned with the science of signs. That the entire universe is perfused with signs, if it is not composed entirely of signs. So the whole universe is a system of signs. And he had a complex system of 10 trichotomies. Peirce is famous for his idea of thirdness, that things come in threes, as it were. And he has a very complex system of 10 categories of signs that he analyses. Well, the most famous of which is this symbol, index, icon distinction. These three things, symbol, index, and icon, that's what he's most famous for. And what is a symbol then? A symbol is very close to Saussure's understanding of the sign. So when Peirce talks about symbol, it really is very close to what Saussure means by sign, which is conventional language largely, and that's arbitrary. The nature, the relation between the signifier and the signified for Peirce with relation to the symbol is arbitrary. So what is a bit confusing, I suppose, but what Saussure calls a sign, Peirce calls a symbol, and that relationship is arbitrary. But what Peirce adds, although he didn't know about Saussure, he hadn't read Saussure, these are thinkers working entirely independently of each other, but what Peirce adds is that a symbol is always requires an interpretation. You have within a symbol you have signifier and a signifier, and it always requires a third thing, which is an interpretation of it, and therefore an interpretant as well. We're looking at that in a second. So you've got symbols, these three, symbol, index, and icon. An index is a signifier connected to its signified. Where a symbol, there's no connection, no inherent connection. According to Peirce, for an index, there is an inherent connection between a signifier and a signified. So smoke is an index of fire. I can't think of another example at the moment. Sorry, my mind's gone blank suddenly. Smoke is an index of fire. Pain is, pain would be an index of illness. I suppose someone red and fuming steam coming up the ears would be an index of anger or something. And then you've got an icon then. An icon is where the signifier does have a relationship to the signifier and resembles the signifier. It's a map, so uses the word, as a map resembles the country that it's representing. So there's not an arbitrary relation, but there's a relation of resemblance. And there's a Borges, I don't know if you've ever read Borges, but a short story writer, dead now, Russian, Argentinian short story writer. There's a wonderful story of a Chinese emperor, it's purely mythological, who has wants a map as large as his kingdom to exactly represent every detail of the kingdom. So they produce this map and cover this area with it, and the map kind of rots into the ground, so you can't tell the difference anymore. So that's an interesting, and I kind of a postmodern idea that the signifier has become the signifies in a sense in Borges' story. But so anyway, so yeah, a map then for purse is an icon. And in all of these relationships, symbols, indexes, and icons, thirdness is there's what he calls thirdness is important. Thirdness. Which is a third thing, always a third thing, which is the interpretation or interpretant of this relationship. There always has to be a third thing, which is the interpretant of those three of that relationship. So, any sign system, any semiotics is always triangular. There's always three things in it for person. That's really what he's important for contributing to this discussion. The third, which is a sign, is always a sign of something for someone, of some community, or something else. So a symbol always requires an interpretation. I'm thinking that birds flying south for the winter would be another icon. No, an index would be an index, not an index.
It could be an index of the changing
seasons. Yeah, that's right.
It indicates
something. So it's not a symbol, but an icon. Index, sorry. So most of cultural analysis then is concerned with symbols for Peirce. So that's most of his work was concerned with symbols in his multi-volumed works. Now, following Peirce and particularly Barthes, following Peirce and Saussure, you have the development of structuralism, particularly in linguistics first, and then in anthropology. And a thinker called Barthes and Jakobson. And there's an emphasis on long, the system of speech, the system of speech. And Barthes introduces an important, common sense, obvious now, understanding of communication, in which you have a message. A sender sends a message to a receiver, which is kind of obvious, really. And then the receiver feeds back information to the sender, like whether they received it, did you get my phone call, did you get my email, that kind of thing. And that the message in that relationship, there's always redundancy or noise in that relationship, and to make a message effective, to have the message the sender's got to send something to the receiver, and that's always has to be embedded or encoded in a certain form, and there's a lot of redundancy in it in order for the message to get through. There's got to be redundancy within the message, or within that which surrounds the message. So you have to keep repeating yourself and stuff like that to get a message through. Or you say something and then it's not understood. The feedback is misunderstanding, so you have to send it again in a different way. So that's Barthes, and that sort of system also influences anthropology, particularly Levi-Strauss, who you may have known the work of, and also literary and cultural studies. And there's another thinker who wasn't a much older thinker called Bakhtin, a Russian thinker, who was extremely important, and his work has come to the West through Kristeva, who we were going to read for this session, but I decided not to do that. So that's roughly a kind of sketch, if you like, of it's not a very full sketch, but of semiotics. But the most important thing being pers and de saussure, and the arbitrary nature of the sign. And pers is understanding of thirdness, that there's always a third, there's always an interpretant in the relationship between the signifier and the signified. Now, that was all probably common. That was all probably fairly basic. Was that for everyone? Did you all know that?
In the previous lecture, I had no concept of philosophy. Understanding the signifier and the signified. I just wondered whether it should have been the other way around. By drawing that mushroom-like squiggle.
Yeah.
That signifies. That would be the signifier. That is the signifier of a rickshaw.
Oh, yeah, that's supposed to be a tree.
Yes, I mean, I'm just being.
Okay, let's have that as a tree.
Is this the. When you put this under signifier,
yeah.
So is this what is being signified?
Yeah, by those words.
By those words.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That way around.
Yeah,
okay.
Now, there's an ambiguity there. Is what is being signified the object, or the referent? It's not. I mean, there's an ambiguity whether it's the object, like the chair out there, or whether it's the object in a semiotic system, in a system of reference and that's being referred to. And then you get. Post-structuralism coming along, post-modernism, post-structuralism, and saying, okay, you've got the arbitrary nature between these two. This, in a sense, drops out of the picture, and all we have are signifiers related to each other. So what determines the meaning of tree? Not the object, not the signified, but its relationship to other terms within the system. So tree is meaningful, not because it refers to the object external to language, but because of what Derrida called différence. It's that the meaning of tree is determined by its not meaning other things. So a tree isn't a cat, a tree isn't a monkey,
a dog
or a rabbit or something. A tree is determined by its place in language. And so the relationship, almost becomes idealism in a sense. So the relationship between the system of language and that which is outside language becomes deeply problematic. So you get someone like Derrida saying there's nothing outside the text, which means nothing outside the system of language, because all you've got are the signifiers. The link's been broken with signifiers. So
and how does he deal with problem where one word can have two objects that are signified? For example,
this could be a family tree.
It could be the family tree.
You could have a family tree or a tree, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So then what happens?
Then the meaning is determined purely by the context of its utterance. It's,
And does the overall word, the signified, is always an exemplar or a particular one?
Well, this is a question. This is the general. This is often. Derrida's critique of some of this is that this could be the Platonic form, some abstract universal or something like the universal form of tree or dog that these different words refer to. Now, the post structures and what's to get away from that, what's to break that link? Because you don't have these universal forms which words are referring to. The meaning of a word is in language, purely in the language system. And you can't get outside of the language system to speak about that to which the words refer, like some abstract Platonic form. This is almost like the realm of ideas, a pure form of the tree or something like that. But the post-structuralist would want to distance themselves from that kind of language. So what you have is a system of language. We're all locked into this system of intertextuality, system of language, system of utterance, which is always historical and interconnected. To understand one element of it, it's like a spider's web. To understand this bit, you pull this bit out, it takes a whole lot with it. You have to understand the totality. So the meaning of one bit is only meaningful in relation to the rest of it, that which it is not. So a tree is not a cat or a dog or a monkey. But there's a problem there, because one form of that can lead to an extreme kind of relativism in which you're completely locked into your language. But experience obviously shows that we can learn other people's languages. We do inhabit other worlds as well. And so it's a complex kind of thing. So Derrida's différence, which he, that famous term, which isn't a French term, which is a with this A, where's it an E? But it's to defer meaning. Meaning is always deferred. You never arrive at a final meaning because of the open-endedness of language. The meaning is always deferred, and the difference of one. Of language, linguistic terms are different from other linguistic terms. So the meaning of terms in language is determined by what they are not. So the meaning is always deferred, put away, put back for the future, as it were. Never arrived at. Final meaning is never arrived at, according to Derrida. And the meaning of a term is because a tree is not a cat or a dog. It's always different. Difference and to defer are fused in this term difference. So okay, you've got two stages then, I suppose, in the history. You've got the structuralists you've got the early semioticians, Peirce and de Saussure, and then you've got the structuralists coming along who developed that three things. Then you've got the post-structuralists who, having the structuralists and the early linguists have separated the signifier from the signified, and the post-structuralists then completely ditch the signified. So all you have are the signifiers and the interrelationship of systems of meaning, and you get the idea that all we have, there's nothing outside the text, all we have is language. We completely inhabit the text,
how can they do that? How can they take out the signifier?
By assuming that there's agreeing with Saussure that the relationship between these two is arbitrary or conventional in the first place. So all different. It's easier with nouns, but you've got all these different nouns for an object, which are equivalent. Bricksha, Baum, tree, and so on. They all mean this. They all refer to a tree, they're all words for tree. So there's no inherent connection between the two of them, as can be established by that kind of thing. Okay, so if there's no inherent connection between language and what it signifies, external to language, all you have is systems of signification. And so the object of human inquiry becomes systems of signification and not that which is outside of them, because on that account, it's a kind of pessimistic, and said you can't get outside of systems of signification. All we have are systems we inhabit. We're born into them as human beings. So we have different cultural worlds that we inhabit, different systems of signification, and you can't get outside of them. So it's a scepticism towards claims to objectivity, in a sense, which can lead to an extreme kind of relativism. So, it's a reaction against positivism too in the philosophy of that language really does refer to the world in some way. They're the response to what's the world? The world is purely within text and culture. How can you get outside of that to an extra-textual reality? Well, physicists will come along and say, well, you start doing experiments and stuff. But then quantum physicists might come along and say, but you're entailed in your experiment or something. So it's quite a complex kind of thing.
Professor Ramchandran did a little experiment at he's from America, a neuropsychologist, in terms of how there are certain sounds and certain objects we have an inherent relationship. Like when you say something or blobby, it doesn't matter what language you are, you look at something roundish.
Mm.
And the same thing, scratchy, the noise that we make and the picture drawn has got some kind
in
of
different languages.
Yeah. So the sounds that we make,
yeah,
and what object it personifies, there is some connection.
Yeah.
So there is an inherent.
So there's a relationship between.
There is a relationship between the two.
The two, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised to find you at all. That. So that, I mean, the other thing, of course, against the kind of the postmodern, post-structural, cultural understanding is, of course, brain science and all that. There is objectivity. We can study cognition and so on across cultures, and that gives rise to language. So.
I was just bringing it in terms of that you said that the signifier and the signified, there's something arbitrary created, but I think he was looking at how language would have originated.
Yeah.
That there's certain sounds we seem to inherently connect with.
With
certain types of objects.
Well, yes, like splosh or something, or onomatopoeic theory of language. It's a revival. I was not surprised. That's like they thought that in the 19th century, in a sense. So it's kind of a revival of that kind of.
It's
way
sort
of
looking at the origin of how we started.
The
language starts. It's a communication.
Yeah.
And where certain sounds seem to have the same, very similar meaning.
Yeah.
To everyone in the group. So from that evolves the language.
That's right. It must be something like that, mustn't it? People are sort of grunting with each other and sort of pointing at rhinoceros or whatever. But the postmodernists aren't interested in hardware, aren't interested in brains and that. They're interested in pure cultural systems. And Chris Daber was, she introduced the notion of intertextuality that from Bakhtin, actually. Bakhtin had an idea that all utterances are, you can only, any sentence you utter can only be understood by reference to other sentences. So again, that's a sentence understood from what it is not, in a sense. So there's intertextuality means that phrases and sentences echo other sentences in a chain of sentences, and anticipate future sentences as well. So texts for Bakhtin, and indeed for Chris Daber, who introduced Bakhtin to the Western world, are always intertextual. There's always reference in a text. So the more you know about the context and the history, the more you understand a text because of the intertextuality. So texts are always echoing and reflecting each other at a conscious level and an unconscious level.
That would be very different from Derrida's point of view, that it's just the experience of the text itself.
Pardon? about intertextuality, to my knowledge, very much. But, I think he'd be happy with intertextuality, though, Derrida, that utterances are only meaningful in reference to others in a system of language.
But would that apply to texts also? The texts would be only meaningful. Would it also gain their meaning in reference to other texts?
Yeah, very much so. Good point, yes. So you can only understand one text with reference to others, as it were. So, Dante couldn't have understood James Joyce, or even could it be translated, as it were, or Boja. Well, I don't know anyone. No one can understand James Joyce. But Boja couldn't have understood. A Bengali novel, you know, later on. So it's interesting, isn't it? I'm saying that, but how do we know that? We might have been able to. But the point is that language texts are developed through history and are referred to other texts. That's his point, really. So, on these, I was going to get you to read Barthes Wrestling with the Angel. On this text before us, we got Wrestling with the Angel. And this is the text from the Bible, Genesis. Okay, that same night he rose, and taking his two wives and his two slave girls and his 11 children, he crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and sent all his possessions over too, and Jacob was left alone. And there was one that wrestled with him until daybreak, who, seeing that he could not master him, struck him in the socket of his hip, and Jacob's hip was dislocated as he wrestled with him. He said, "Let me go, for day is breaking." But Jacob answered, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." He then asked, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he replied. He said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. Because you have been strong against God, you shall prevail against men." Jacob then made this request, "I beg you, tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. Jacob named the place Peniel, "because I have seen God face to face," he said, "and I have survived." The sun rose as he left Peniel, limping because of his hip. That is the reason why, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the sciatic nerve, which is in the socket of the hip, because he had struck Jacob in the socket of the hip on the sciatic nerve. So, that's a very strange text. And I thought we'd look at this in terms of, not follow Barthes' analysis of it, which is interesting in itself, but look at it in terms of this sign signifier interpretant triangle. So you've got, Barthes' structural analysis, he says you've got certain structures in that text. Like a river. This is me, this is Martin. So on one hand you've got a sacred realm and like a profane realm. And he sends his wives and slave girls back across from the sacred realm into this. So this becomes a sacred realm, across the river, across that liminal, that boundary, if you like. So he's then in this sacred space, and he wrestles with this being in the sacred space. And then he goes back over that side. It sounds like Bedlam, isn't it? He goes back into the profane realm, having had this encounter in the sacred realm, as it were. And it's a very rich passage, this, I think. there's a number of elements in here. There's the naming too, the idea that you know the name of the angel and you gain control over over that level, over that power, through having the name is there. And the angel, of course, resists, doesn't tell him, what is your name? Oh no, sorry, what is here? The angel asked Jacob what his name is. So I thought there was something about the angel's name. There isn't. I'm projecting that into the text.
And I beg you,
so
tell me your
ask
name.
Well. He asks. Yeah, he does. He asks the angel. Why do you ask me your name? He doesn't tell him.
Yeah. But then he decides to name the place Peniel.
Yeah.
And there is no reason why it should be called Peniel.
I don't know what it means, Peniel, but presumably it must mean something related to that incident. Could be the name of an angel, couldn't it, Peniel?
Could have been, but I'm just trying to bring that in to say that the word Vriksha has got no relationship to tree.
Mm.
He just called a tree Vriksha.
Well, I think in this text, this would assume a completely different understanding of language, in which names do have inherent
meaning.
Mm. And are deeply connected with what they refer to. So, you know, your secret initiatory name would not be would be connected with your essence, kind of idea, I think, probably. So if we apply that semiotic, you've got there's multi-level. So a signifier. If Jacob is a no, let's look at the angel. Let's look at the angel. The angel is a signifier of what? I don't know any more than you. I'm just sort of a question of signifier.
No, all I can look at is tell you based on Darth Vader's experience.
Yeah.
Go into the cave and you experience your own inner evil self.
Right.
So Yoda sends Luke Skywalker, he says, go into the cave and you'll see your own worst self, and that will be the Darth Vader. So the angel is in a way his own bad self.
Okay, so you get the angel. If this is a signifier, if the angel is a signifier of what? And the one idea
of his evil emotions.
That's Jacob's evil self.
Yeah, evil self.
Why do you think the angel is evil?
Because he goes and kicks his hip in.
Oh, I see. Yeah, right. Yeah.
What a nice thing to do. I'm sorry, I'm too basic. Right.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? He kicks
sort of
his hip.
In the text, it doesn't say that he's angel, actually. It is a title of angel. It says to God.
Yeah, the angel. It doesn't say an angel, does it? No.
Wrestling with the angel.
Only after that Jacob says that I faced the God.
Yes.
So you have been strong against God.
So in that sense, then, if it is this being, whoever doesn't say an angel. I wrestled with. There was one that wrestled with him.
Yep.
So let's call. Let's put angel in inverted commas. Call it the one that wrestled. So that's what we have. We have the one that wrestled with him. We don't know it's an angel.
Yes. The title is an angel, of course.
The title is the angel, yeah. I think that's tradition that says it's an angel. So we've got one that wrestled with him. What if that's a signifier of what? What we had one evil self. There's another angel is another later understanding that the signifier is the angel. But here it doesn't seem to be the angel. It's as you said further down. It's because I have seen God face to face. So it's God. So the one that wrestled with him, there's certainly an ambiguity. It could be, I mean, according to this text, it looks like it's God that wrestled with him. Because I've seen God face to face, and I have survived.
It seems to me that it can be a kind of challenge, the initiatory challenge.
Yeah.
Can be interpreted as an initiation process, is the challenge. Eventually, it is a particular name which
allows him to cross the river.
Right, right. Yeah, he's given a name which allows him to. Yes, that's right. So you've got that you've got the journey idea, and you've got you're right, an initiatory challenge that he overcomes and succeeds in, and then he gets this name, or he names the place. He gets some kind of knowledge, or something, power. And the sun rose as he left.
Because I think in the Upanishads that this knowing the connections between the superficial details and the cosmic connections gives the power.
Yeah.
Kind of parallel.
Yeah. The homologies, the bandhas, the connections. So, and then you've got a bit of etiological myth there, you know, about sciatic nerves. So, and the thing, I mean, the interpretant is, of course, Jacob, in some sense, in that triangular relationship. But then also you've got other levels there, because you've got the community of reception of the text. It is a biblical text, you've got the Israelites, and so you've got the signifier. The text itself signifies, what does the text itself signify? And you've got... you could put all sorts of things here. The relationship between the people of Israel and God. You could apply an externalist analysis like yours, in the sense of like an initiatory type understanding or something. For whom? For a community of readers, depending on who they are. And, you know, with reference to earlier texts, again, intertextuality, that he, if you see, you can't see the face of God and live, you know. But he has, he's seen God face to face, and I have survived.
So I understand, is it necessarily, I guess it's not necessary that he wrestled against God. Because it's possible that the blessing was to see God.
Right, rather than wrestling. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because for some reason it seems as though he says you have been strong against God. He says that earlier on.
Yeah.
But it could be strong against the angel, and therefore he's been strong against the power of God.
Right. So if this is an angel, if the one that wrestled with him is not God himself but another, then that one has reflected the power of God, if you like, and that's who he's been strong against.
This reminds me in some ways when Nachiketas goes to Yamadharma Maharaja, and he's as stubborn as anything. He sits there for 4 days waiting for him, and then when Yamadharma Maharaja gives him, I said, I'll give you this. No,
yeah.
I want the absolute knowledge.
Yes.
And it's almost like this sort of wrestling.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it is.
In the Upanishad, it comes up.
Yeah. So that's a good cue. We've got 10 minutes. Let's move on to the other passage quickly. I'll leave you to think about that. Usually when we do this sort of thing, we go up in the groups and stuff like that, but we don't do that today. And this is for the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Have I given you the right bit? So 2, verse 2, chapter 1, verse 2. In the beginning there was nothing here at all. Death alone covered this completely, as did hunger, for what is hunger but death? Then death made up his mind, let me equip myself with a body. So he undertook a liturgical recitation, and as he was engaged in liturgical recitation, water sprang from him, and he thought, while I was engaged in liturgical recitation, water sprang up for me. This is what gave the name to and discloses the true nature of recitation. Water undoubtedly springs from him who knows the name and nature of recitation in this way. So recitation is water. Then the foam that gathered on the water solidified and became the earth. Death toiled upon her. when he had become worn out by the toil of hot, by toil and hot with exertion, his heat, his essence, turned into fire. He divided his body, this body of his, into three. One third became the sun, another the wind. He's also breath divided into three. His head is the eastern quarter, and his two forequarters are the southeast and the northeast. His tail is the west, and his two hindquarters are the southwest and the northwest. His flanks are the south and the north. His back is the sky, his abdomen is the intermediate regions, and his chest is the earth. He stands firm in the waters. A man who knows this will stand firm wherever he may go. Then death had this desire. Would that a second body were born for me. I always think here, though, the word Atman, I mean, although Oliver says it's body, it could be self, couldn't it? Would that a second body or second self were born for me. It could be asking, what is the self of death? What is the essence of death? So, by means of his mind, he copulated with speech, death copulated with hunger. Then the semen he emitted became the year. The year simply did not exist before this. He carried him for as long as a year, at the end of which he gave birth to him. As he was born, death opened his mouth and swallowed him and cried out, "Barn." That is what became speech. Death reflected, "If I kill him, I will only reduce my supply of food." So, with that speech and that body, he gave birth to this whole world, to everything that is here. Rig Vedic verses, Yajurvedic formulas, Samavedic chants, meters, sacrifices, people and animals. He began to eat whatever he gave birth to. He eats all. It is this that gave the name to and discloses the true nature of Aditi. When someone comes to know the name and nature of Aditi in this way, he becomes the eater of this whole world, and the whole world here becomes his food. Then death had this desire. "Let me make an offering once more, this time with a bigger sacrifice." So he strenuously toiled and fiercely exerted himself. When he had become worn out by toil and hot with exertion, his splendour, his vigour departed from him. Now, splendour, vigour consisted of his vital breaths. So when his vital breaths had departed, his corpse began to bloat. His mind, however, still remained within the corpse. Then he had this desire, "I wish that this corpse of mine would become fit to be sacrificed, so I could get myself a living body." Then that corpse became a horse. Because it bloated, it became fit to be sacrificed. That is what gave the name to and discloses the true nature of the horse sacrifice. Only a man who knows the horse sacrifice in this way truly understands it. Death believed that the horse was not to be confined in any way. At the time of 1 year, he immolated it as a sacrifice to himself. When he assigned the other animals to the gods, that is why people, when they immolate the horse consecrated to Prajapati, regard it as an offering to all the gods. The sun that shines up there clearly is a horse sacrifice, clearly. The year is its body. The sun that burns down here is the ritual fire. These worlds are its body. Now, there are these two, the horse sacrifice and the ritual fire, yet they constitute, in reality, a single deity. They are simply death. Whoever knows this averts repeated death. Death is unable to seize him. Death becomes his very body, and he becomes one of these deities. Well.
Utter confusion.
Utter complexity, yes. Utter confusion. Well, yeah. Now, this is... the first Upanishad, this is the second verse of the first Upanishad, and you're launched into this incredibly complex kind of narrative of this, of death, really, about the nature of death. You've got death, you've got the origins of the universe, it's an origin myth as well. It's a myth about the nature of the sacrifice, it's about desire, it's an incredibly rich text, really, so I thought we'd have a look at it, if possible, in terms of our semiotic triangle. So who's the main character in this passage, then?
Death.
Looks like death is the main character. what does death signify?
To begin with, loneliness.
Loneliness, that's a good point. Right, loneliness. Yeah, that's right, loneliness. Because he's on his own, isn't he?
That's the desire,
yeah.
Of the course of creation.
Yeah. Yeah. So in our text here, we've got death, and then loneliness, solitude. Wait, he says that. Let's see if we can make that text specific. Right at the beginning, yeah. Yeah, in the beginning, there was nothing here at all. Death alone.
Covered this completely.
Yeah. As did hunger. What is hunger but death?
Could death possibly be hunger?
Hunger, yeah. There's hunger. So he wanted a body, or perhaps a self. I mean, it says, I mean, that's an interpretation of Atman.
Also, the very first sentence, the beginning, there was nothing here at all. Nothing.
Yes, nothing.
Death is also
nothing. So death is nothingness.
Nothingness.
Yeah. Yeah, death is nothingness. And then he says, let me have a body. It's just strange. It's full of paradox and ambiguity. You know, you've got death is nothing, and yet death wants something, wants a body, wants a self. So the question is, what's the nature of death, I think the question.
Unmanifest.
Is he unmanifest? It must be if he doesn't have a...
Because when you look at the Srishti, Sthiti and Laya,
yeah.
Laya is the unmanifest.
Yeah.
Death is unmanifest.
Yeah. But he's not unmanifest, is he? Because he's...
Begins to manifest.
It begins to manifest, yeah. So at first he's unmanifest.
Yeah. Then he wants to have the manifestation.
Yeah.
Then he feels, I'm all alone, I need to have a partner.
That's right.
And they keep chasing each other and hiding you and creating more and more partners.
That's right. Yeah.
That's a simplistic story.
Yeah, it's true. It's what happens. When he's engaged in surgical elicitation. Water sprang up from him. Water is like life, I guess. Like
a bunch of waters are coming out.
Waters are coming out from his recitation. So death is a source of life. It's a very strange text.
Well, if you look at later on, in the explanation goes as Srishti, Sthiti and Laya.
Yeah.
When the pralaya happens, you're going into the karana shariram, or the causal state.
Yeah.
Which appears as death.
Yeah. That's a very sophisticated philosophical interpretation.
Yeah, it's a causal state, but from the causal state to the potential state, that could also mean the potential state.
Yeah, potential, okay, it signifies nothingness. Yeah, that's right, it does, it signifies potentiality.
Because from the potential state comes the manifest state,
yeah.
And various manifestations are appearing.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then the third thing, for whom, I mean, I don't know who the interpretant is. I mean, that's a later interpretation, so that's the tradition interpreting it in that way. Perhaps the semiotic analysis doesn't work with his texts so well.
It's actually for himself. It's an odd thing. He's doing it for himself.
Death is the self-interpreting.
Yeah.
Wow. In this text, within the confines of the text. Yeah. Yeah, death is doing it for himself. Because he's lonely.
One of the things that happens in that thing, because I remember I only read the first chapter and the last chapter, I think. Because the last chapter actually tells you how you should get a male progeny.
What
the actual act of sexual intercourse and how it should be done and when it should be done so you can have a male progeny.
In the Brihadaranyaka?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a comparison. You get the first chapter talks about death creating through thought process, wanting and the desire.
Yeah.
And then the other similar creation but at a different level.
That's right, yeah, it does, it reflects it, it's very interesting, yeah. So yeah, death had this desire, would that the second body were born from me. And it's a very strange thing. Then where does speech come from? I mean, and then hunger.
Speech is his verb.
Speech, but there was originally we only had death, and then speech is suddenly there.
But when he swallows something, he burps. I mean, he says, and that becomes speech, doesn't it?
That's before, though, isn't it? That's after. I mean. Yeah.
He
you're right.
Is all.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
is not that gate. I remember whilst you were reading.
So he's eating his second body?
Yes, it looks like it. He's eating his second body. It's terribly complex, this, isn't it? It's amazing.
As he was born, death opened his mouth to swallow him, the
yes.
second body. He cried out, Bhan.
Yes.
That is what became speech.
Oh, yes. 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 So speech is born from death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Death creates something because
yeah.
he wants a companion. Then, because death is still hunger, it wants to eat.
Yeah.
And as it eats, the sound comes out.
It's very interesting. Yeah. So you've got a relationship. I mean, what is speech is linked to being, is linked to existence, and death is linked to nothing. So it's this it's a relationship between being and nothingness that's going on in this text. So we've got to stop, I'm afraid, but
I mean, it all comes to the manifest and the unmanifest of the death and being, and the relation and their relationship is what is existence.
Yes. yes, the existence is a relationship between death and between
and
nothingness and somethingness.
Somethingness.
Yeah. Yeah. That dialectic or whatever. So you have a look at have a reread of this text and look at it in terms of the semiotic triangle. I don't think it works particularly well with that, but have a look at it in terms of phenomenological analysis that we were looking at last week, noesis and noema. Perhaps that might break open the text more for us. But so I thought we looked at two very strange texts, this one with the angel and death in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. No wonder traditions can't make sense of any of this stuff. And look at these sacred texts, if you like, and raise the question of whether these kinds of tools developed in semiotics and phenomenology are of any use at all in understanding what's going on in them. So next week we're doing social science, angle and text and social science, and we're going to look at Paul Ricoeur, and I've got a summary of the argument of his text of his society understood as a text. I can't remember what's the precise. Yeah, social action considered as a text. So that's like reading society, reading culture in terms of a text, which relates to some of the material we'll be looking at today. Sorry, we didn't get very far with the analysis of this, did we? But I think it was a bit overwhelming. Didn't it? So we could talk about it more next week, perhaps. Any questions or points?
Explanation of something we've already known. For example, in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it tried to explain the elements of sacrifice, which signifies the why they use, for some water and so on.
Yeah.
Whereas the previous text, it signifies the why they don't eat the sciatic nerve.
That's right. So the etiological and explanatory in that sense, yeah.
In this sense, it somehow gives the sense of connection between the results as well as the cause of it.
Sure. And both are explanations, both are explanatory texts to explain a present practice at the time. Yeah. Although,
it's not a semiotic, of course.
Yeah, that's a semiotic. Yes, that's a semiotic understanding, that is, but it's... one's sceptical, but I mean, if that doesn't exhaust the explanation. That's why we don't eat the sciatic nerve. It doesn't exhaust the explanation of it, or that's. So these origin myths. So you always think, Oh, it must be more to it than that, as it were, as with the Yama story here.
Because I find that the origin of the psychic nerve, because at that time did they know the psychic nerve existed there?
I think they did. And that will be. Yeah, because it says so in that text.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not a later addition, that's within the text itself. So. Yes, it'd be interesting to kind of, you know, read the two texts together. Perhaps we should do that next time. I'm just trying to switch this off now. Thank you.